that what helped to prompt July 4th, 1776 was the perception amongst European settlers on the North American mainland that London was moving rapidly towards abolition.
Metro would not meet with us.
We out here every day for 4 o'clock.
We trying to see if they gonna sit down to the table with us.
Facing down the NYPD and blocking the streets. And this is all part of the reality that whose borough, their boroughs. Whose housing, their housing. People before profit.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and its affiliates, focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches our lives. I'm your host, Akua Holt. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, we hear from Dr. Gerald Horn, author of The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and an excerpt of What to the Slave is the 4th of July, a speech delivered by Frederick Douglass addressing the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society on July 5th, 1852 in Rochester, New York, read today by James Earl Jones, as well as an excerpt by visionary force and esteemed author, the late Toni Morrison on race, and Spike Freeman, urban planner and organizer with No Olympics LA. But first, the news.
These are the headlines for Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Lily Bulkey. President Donald Trump is visiting the Mount Rushmore National Monument today for a July 4th celebration with an elaborate fireworks display, despite concerns over wildfires and groundwater pollution that have kept fireworks out of South Dakota's Black Hills for the last decade. 7 South Dakota tribes object to his visit. Native reservations have been hit especially hard by COVID-19, and the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe is taking federal officials to court for allegedly abusing government authority by shutting down highway checkpoints to screen people for COVID, checkpoints that were established because of the lack of health services on reservations. Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier is one of the tribal leaders calling for the removal of the faces of 4 past presidents from Mount Rushmore, formerly known by the Lakota Sioux as Hay Sapa, Paha Sapa, or the 6 Grandfathers. Here's Jordan Marie brings 3 White Horses Daniel, an Indigenous organizer who founded the Rising Hearts Coalition.
Mount Rushmore is that symbol of white supremacy and systemic and structural racism. Those are, colonizers' faces, carved into our sacred lands, our sacred mountains, what is known as the Black Hills and Mount Rushmore. To the Lakota, Dakota people, it's Paha Sapa. Like, that's what it means to us.
Vox obtained a letter from Democrats on the Senate Rules Committee to Attorney General William Barr with concerns over the impact of closing in-person voting sites in Native American communities. Attorney Jacqueline DeLeon with the Native American Rights Fund explains some of the challenges Indigenous voters face.
I think that, honestly, the conditions facing Native Americans when they're trying to vote would be shocking to the average American. There's a whole host of them. Those types of unreasonable distances are a big problem and are going to be a big problem come November. You couple that with the inability for Native Americans to receive ballots at their home because of the lack of mail delivery often. So we have a real perfect storm for a lot of problems for Native Americans casting their ballots.
Private First Class Vanessa Guillen was killed in late April with a hammer in the armory room where she worked on Fort Hood, according to her family's lawyer yesterday. The suspected killer was fellow soldier Aaron David Robinson, who apparently took his own life after police confronted him Wednesday. Guillen's family said she'd been planning to file a harassment claim against Robinson the day after she disappeared, and they believe that was his motive. A second suspect, a civilian, is currently in custody for allegedly helping him dispose of Guillen's body. Here's attorney Natalie Kawam at a press conference on Wednesday.
Women should not be afraid to come forth about sexual harassment. They should not fear reporting sexual harassment. This is unacceptable. It's 2020. What's happening? Sexual harassment's not criminal. That was what we were told. Well, guess what? We have a dead person because of sexual harassment. It is criminal. We want legislation. We need legislation so this never happens again.
British publishing heiress Ghislaine Maxwell, long-term girlfriend of billionaire convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, was arrested by the FBI yesterday for allegedly luring teenage girls into being sexually abused by Epstein, who was known to have political connections, including the current president. And New York City's comptroller Scott M. Stringer sent letters to the CEOs of 67 S&P 100 companies, calling on them to publicly disclose their annual breakdown of their workforce by race, ethnicity, and gender, according to 10 employment categories, including senior management. If this data is public, investors can measure whether their diversity and inclusion practices stack up with recent statements condemning racism and affirming commitments to racial equality. Finally, the Detroit Pistons have offered the use of their performance center as a satellite center for Michigan elections. The Atlanta Hawks offered up their State Farm Arena after seeing the long lines and difficulties in Georgia's recent primaries. And the Milwaukee Bucks are hoping to do the same. It's all part of an effort started by LeBron James and other athletes called the More Than a Vote Initiative. And those are the headlines in today's news. I'm Lily Bolke from the Pacifica Affiliate Network.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
As the country celebrates the 4th of July, today we hear a speech delivered by Frederick Douglass. Douglass was a leader of the abolitionist movement. On July 5, 1852, in Rochester, New York, he gave one of his most famous speeches addressing Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society. The title of the speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July? Douglass said, quote, "The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me." Here is James Earl Jones reading the speech during a performance of historian Howard Zinn's acclaimed book, Voices of People's History of the United States.
Fellow citizens, pardon me and allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There's not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
What to the Slave is the 4th of July is the title of this speech by abolitionist Frederick Douglass. Next on COVID, Race, and Democracy, Dr. Gerald Horn, author of The Counter-Revolution of 1776, and Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. Dr. Horn is a professor of history and African-American studies at University of Houston, interviewed by Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Dr. Horn lays out why July 4th is not a day of celebration for Native Americans or African-Americans.
What should we understand about the founding of the United States?
We should understand that July 4th, 1776, in many ways, represents a counter-revolution. That is to say, that what helped to prompt July 4th, 1776 was the perception amongst European settlers on the North American mainland that London was moving rapidly towards abolition. This perception was prompted by Somerset's case, a case decided in London in June 1772, which seemed to suggest that abolition, which not only was going to be ratified in London itself, was going to cross the Atlantic and basically sweep through the mainland, thereby jeopardizing numerous fortunes, not only based upon slavery, but the slave trade. That's the short answer. The longer answer would involve going back to another revolution, that is to say, the so-called Glorious Revolution in England in 1688, which, among other things, involved a step back for the monarch, the king, and a step forward for the rising merchant class. This led to a deregulation of the African slave trade, that is to say, the Royal African Company theretofore had been in control of the slave trade, but with the rising power of the merchant class, this slave trade was deregulated, leading to what I call free trade in Africans. That is to say, merchants then descended upon the African continent, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight with the energy of demented and crazed bees, dragging them across the Atlantic, particularly to the Caribbean and to the North American mainland. This was prompted by the fact that the profits for the slave trade were tremendous, sometimes up to 1,600 or 1,700%. And as you know, there are those even today who will sell their firstborn for such a profit. This, on the one hand, helped to boost the productive forces, both in the Caribbean and on the mainland, but it led to numerous slave revolts, not least in the Caribbean, but also on the mainland, which helped to give the mainlanders second thoughts about London's tentative steps towards abolition.
Gerald Horn, one of the things that struck me in your book is not only your main thesis that this was in large part a counter-revolution, the United States War of Independence, but you also link very closely what was going on in the Caribbean colonies of England as well as in the United States, not only in terms of among the slaves in both areas, but also among the white population. And in fact, you indicate that quite a few of those who ended up here in the United States fostering the American Revolution had actually been refugees from the battles between whites and slaves in the Caribbean. Could you expound on that?
It's well known that up into the middle part of the 18th century, London felt that the Caribbean colonies, Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua in particular, were in some ways more valuable than the mainland colonies. The problem was that in the Caribbean colonies, the Africans outnumbered the European settlers, sometimes at a rate of 20-1, which facilitated slave revolts. There were major slave revolts in Antigua, for example, in 1709 and 1736. The Maroons, that is to say, the Africans who had escaped London's jurisdiction in Jamaica, had challenged the crown quite sternly. This led, as your question suggests, to many European settlers in the Caribbean making the great trek to the mainland, being chased out of the Caribbean by enraged Africans. For example, I did research for this book in Newport, Rhode Island, and the main library there to this very day is named after Abraham Redwood, who fled Antigua after the 1736 slave revolt, because many of his, quote, Africans, unquote, were involved in this slave revolt. And he fled in fear and established the main library in Newport to this very day and helped to basically establish that city on the Atlantic coast. So there is a close connection between what was transpiring in the Caribbean and what was taking place on the mainland. And historians need to recognize that even though these colonies were not necessarily a unitary project, there were close and intimate connections between and amongst them.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston.
Pacifica Radio is once again doing what it does best, to inform you about one of the most important issues of our time, the coronavirus, COVID-19. We are producing a national show with reports, insights, and cultural expressions from all five Pacifica stations and its radio affiliates. The daily show, COVID, Race, and Democracy, is about the impact of the pandemic and the growing struggle for social, racial, and economic justice. Please listen and tell a friend. And visit our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org, and subscribe to the Pacifica Foundation TV on YouTube. It will be worth it.
times, all the time. Destruction of minds, bodies, and human rights. Stripped of bloodlines, whipped and confined. This is the American pride. It's justifying a genocide, romanticizing the theft and bloodshed that made America the land of the free. To take a black life, land of the free, to bring a gun to a peaceful fight for civil rights. You are desensitized to pulling triggers on innocent lives because that's how we got here in the first place. These wounds sink deeper than the bullet your entitled hands could ever reach. Generations and generations of pain, fear, and anxiety. Equality is walking without intuition, saying the protector and the killer is wearing the same uniform. The revolution is not televised. Media perception is forced down the throats of closed minds, so it's lies in the headlines and generations of supremacy resulting in your ignorant, privileged eyes. We breathe the same and we bleed the same, but still we don't see the same. Be thankful we are God-fearing because we do not seek revenge. We seek justice. We are past fear. We are fed up eating your shit because you think your so-called black friend validates your wokeness and erases your racism. That kind of uncomfortable conversation is too hard for your trust fund pockets to swallow. To swallow the strange fruit hanging from my family tree because of your audacity to say all men are created equal in the eyes of God, but disparage a man based on the color of his skin. Do not say you do not see color. When you see us, see us. We can't breathe.
Listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Up next, city workers' unions in New Orleans have been on strike for an increase in wages.
My name is Janoa Taylor.
My name is D'Artagnan DeJean.
My name is Jerry Simon.
Anthony Perkins.
Harold Peter.
Jermaine Williams.
Darnell Harris.
Kendrick Anderson.
Gurney Taylor.
My name is Jonathan Ewell.
Janar Bristol.
I'm Jamal Taylor.
My name is Ramon Brooks. I'm from City Waste Union. Been striking for 4 weeks now.
Been at Metro for almost a decade.
Been hopping for over 20 years.
This is one of the hardest jobs in the world. You know what I'm saying? A bill garbage man. You know what I'm saying? Come out your everyday, no matter what weather, picking up everything. Let me clean the whole route up.
If you know New Orleans garbage, it's real nasty and heavy.
We bust all back ends out here to keep the city clean.
We work from sun up to sundown. I have days where I work from 4 in the morning to 10 o'clock at night.
It's only enough to, you know, pay your bills or get, you know, whatever you can get done, and then you got to get back to work. It's such a little amount of money. You work every single day, even that day that they give you off. You kind of want to go to work that day as well because it's just not enough money.
We don't get no health benefits. We don't get no sick days.
I got hurt several times on the truck where I wind up in the hospital. It's not right. It's not right. You know, it's time. It's time for everybody to realize and know what's going on.
Pick up garbage all day, and we love doing it. We love keeping the city clean.
But we just tired of the beating we getting right now, you know, so we just took a stand and we went on strike.
We are now on strike in front of Metro for a change in wages.
Right now we're making $10.25 an hour, and you got to work 5 days just to get $11 an hour. So what we asking for, we ain't asking for a lot. We asking for $15 an hour.
We deserve more than that, but we know we're asking for $15.
And we are striking for better
working conditions, proper PPE.
The COVID-19 hit, they gave us one pair of gloves, like garden gloves, gave us one mask for the whole day. And we'd be out there 16 hours a day sometime. And one pair of gloves, that is not right.
We are asking for safety. You know, we have a lot of trucks that leak, spew, spray, and gush hydraulic fluid. We're looking for hazard pay as well. You know, $150 a week. We are the frontline workers too. I understand we're not a police officer, we're not a firefighter, we're not a nurse. But you gotta think about it. If it wasn't for us, who would get y'all garbage? How y'all garbage be taken out every day?
Metro would not meet with us.
We out here every day for 4 o'clock.
We trying to see if they gonna sit down to the table with us. All right, now at the moment, we ain't been hearing nothing back from them.
We trying to stay strong, and I know we gonna get there. Because I know everybody waiting for this to be over. I know I am. I'm ready to go back to work.
On behalf of City Waste Union, we'd like to thank you guys for your continuous support. Your donations greatly appreciated. It's going to take care of the 15 hoppers and their families.
The money is not just being used for petty things. This is for our families that we are on strike for.
Without y'all, you know, we can't do it.
We just young men working, providing for our family.
The GoFundMe helped me provide food for my family. Put gas in the car for me to make it out here to support the rest of me and my brothers.
Thank everybody for helping us while we've been on strike.
We really, really grateful.
I want to thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank y'all so much.
Thank you.
Thank y'all.
Thank you. We appreciate you from the bottom of my heart.
That was City Workers Union of New Orleans thanking their supporters throughout the country. Malcolm X shares his thoughts on American democracy.
But don't scare Negroes today with no badge or no white skin or no white sheet or no white anything else. The police the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you. Bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this, and it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim, and then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him. This is American justice. This is American democracy. And those of you who are familiar with it know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy. Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail. But if you can't prove that if democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
The late Toni Morrison shares her wisdom as an esteemed elder on race. She was a novelist, book editor, and professor. She wrote Bluest Eye, the critically acclaimed Song of Solomon, and won the Pulitzer Prize for Beloved. She gained worldwide recognition when she was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature.
And possibly equal as it does black people. I always knew that I had the moral high ground all my life. I always thought those people who said I couldn't come in the drugstore and I had to sit in these funny places, I couldn't
go
in the park.
You felt morally superior to them from day one.
And I thought they knew that I knew that they were inferior to me morally. I always thought that. And my parents always thought that. But if the racist white person, I don't mean the person who is examining his consciousness and so on, doesn't understand that he or she is also a race, it's also constructed, it's also made, and it also has some kind of serviceability. But when you take it away, I take your race away, and there you are, all strung out, and all you got is your little self. And what is that? What are you without racism? Are you any good? Are you still strong? You still smart? You still like yourself? I mean, these are the questions. It's part of it is, yes, the victim, how terrible it has been for black people.
But you don't like that.
I'm not a victim. I refuse to be one.
And the victim is the other person who is morally inferior and
that's
who
what, that's a
has
serious
to hold
question.
On to
of course.
Racism
if you
for
have
somehow,
to hold, that's
for his or her own self-esteem and definition.
If you can only be tall because somebody's on their knees, then you have a serious problem. And my feeling is white people have a very, very serious problem. And they should start thinking about what they can do about it. Take me out of it.
Then give white people some free advice.
They're all in my books.
And the advice is to come to grips.
Of course.
With your own fears.
Absolutely.
Your own
Look at
fears.
It. Absolutely. Your own fears, your own history, and what you need. What do you need this for? You know, it's not, I said glibly a moment ago, and it feels good. It must feel good, otherwise they'd give
Would
it up. It. It's wasteful.
Right.
It costs a lot. It's ugly. It hurts. What are you paying for that
it's
for?
Driven by fear.
That's right.
Yeah. Give me your take on Rodney King and Los Angeles and all of that experience.
The most remarkable thing to me about Rodney King and what happened afterwards was people kept saying, oh, this terrible explosion, oh, the riots, oh, this awful and could have been avoided, or what is it about? What struck me most about the people who were burning down shops and stealing was how long they waited. The restraint, not the spontaneity, the restraint. You realize the moment to be anarchic was when we saw those tapes. When we first saw those tapes.
They waited for justice.
They waited. How long was that? 9 months? A year? Yeah. They waited for justice almost a year and didn't come. No one talks about the fact that no one ran out into the streets as I wanted to. I was sitting in there with my son. It was like a ballet. It was unbelievable. And I think everybody felt that way. And no one, they didn't do a thing. They waited. That's amazing. That's amazing to me.
That was novelist Toni Morrison, author of Bluest Eye, Song of Solomon, and Beloved. Thank you for staying with us on COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Mikul Holt. As civil courts reopen, tenant advocates in Brooklyn, New York, fearing coronavirus and mass evictions, protested, chanted, "Shut it down." Throughout the state of New York, thousands of tenants and housing rights advocates appeared at the courthouses chanting, "Housing is healthcare." They marched in the streets to stop the housing courts from reopening for the filing of an estimated 50 to 60,000 new eviction proceedings. As the pandemic-related moratorium on evictions expired and demanded that Governor Cuomo extended the moratorium for all New Yorkers and to cancel rent and mortgage payments for the duration of the crises. Here, advocate and lawyer Mimi Rosenberg, host and producer of Equal Rights and Justice from our sister station, WBAI.
Tenants Association, and I'm here to tell you a story about a friend of mine who got COVID back in March. When my friend got diagnosed with COVID, he was in the hospital for 2 weeks. When he got out, he has insurance, and his hospital bill was over $35,000. A week later, he lost his job. Now, we all know between the one-time $1,200 check and the additional $600 in unemployment per week, the total amount of relief that people are getting under $75,000 is $13,550. I know y'all can do math. What's 35,000 minus $13,550? And I'm only going to ask you, how we going to eat? How he going to pay his rent? So we're looking for relief. When Jabari talks about health care and health care justice, this is what he's talking about. Yeah. We're not getting anything, and so we're not going anywhere. No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
People's housing over profit.
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 We're gonna do a little march around this block. Let them know. Now we're still here, we're still fighting. But I just want to remember to remind folks to keep putting pressure on Cuomo. Call them. Call the chief judges. Reach out to the Senate organizing groups that are in your neighborhood. Organize.
Put pressure every week. We gotta stop the bleeding.
We're on the block of housing court now, which is located in Brooklyn at 141 Livingston Street, and a number of people are now facing down the NYPD and blocking the streets. And this is all part of the reality that whose borough, their boroughs. Whose housing, their housing. People before profit. Obviously, the demands are being broadened out. Black lives matter, brown lives matter. And now everybody's joined this brother blocking the streets. And now there is the entire group that has marched around all of the courts in downtown Brooklyn that are facing down on one of the major thoroughfares, which is Livingston Street, off of Borum, which is the exit for the bridges. As you can hear, they're blocking it, and they're blocking maybe 10 or 15 patrol cars. You're here with a huge group of tenants. One brother took the stance of blocking off the streets.
He's with Equality for Flatbush.
Uh-huh. So tell us.
You might want to talk. She's fat.
What's going on?
Well, you took it by yourself.
Yeah.
And now you brought the whole block, the streets. Talk about the issue.
I saw the cops following us, and we did not invite them to the protest. They are our enemies. They are not our friends. The police oppress us. They are used to promote evictions that are used to go through with all sorts of justification on all sorts of violence. NYPD, any forces that stand to oppress the black and brown peoples of this world, it is over. We are done.
And you are with what group? What group are you with?
E4F, Equality for Flatbush.
Amani, are you pleased that the issues of Black Lives Matter, Brown Lives Matter are being broadened out to deal with housing, health care, and other issues?
It is a Black Lives Matter. The majority of tenants in this country are black and brown people. This is what we need and should be doing every day. And it's just a natural understanding that black people are putting their bodies on the line for all issues. That is the way it is. Because we have nothing to lose at this point but our chains. Every issue impacts
us. And you see the issues, by the way, of ethnic cleansing, COVID being used to empty the borough of black and brown. We're clear that this is all by design, whether it be the lack of health care, with food insecurities, the first one, you know, the last one hired, the first one's fired. We see the layoffs. All of this is about racism systemically. All the police violence, all the tenant struggles are about systemically about racism.
And what organization are you with?
I'm with Equality for Flatbush.
Thank you. Can I grab you for 2 seconds? So right now, I'm wondering if you see the issue. There are a dozen lawyers here, including myself and Esteban. And they know what they do. They got to do what they want to do. So these are tenants now. And now, actually, people are dancing in the streets. We'll see what the officers have gotten out of their cars now. We'll see what happens. I do notice that some of the police officers have covered up their badge numbers. Others, I'm sorry to say, have distinct tattoos that are absolutely of the fascist ilk. You have to understand, the police are the police are the police. There has not been any order given to disperse, and people are blocking the housing court.
Advocate and lawyer Mimi Rosenberg, host and producer of Equal Rights and Justice from our sister station, WBAI.
They systematically trying to kill us, now that's the scariest. I swear the numbers getting various. I'm feeling like I'm Harriet, an underground soldier for my people that I'm carrying. They killed George Floyd, now I'm trying to fill the void. This the life my brother's living, it's really hard to avoid. I keep my hoodie on for Trayvon, I do it for my day ones. Sandra Bland spoke about the path that we should stay on. I can't breathe through this nonsense, the killings coming constant. The crooked politicians is never willing to stop this. Yeah, Breonna Taylor, say her name, say it again. Breonna Taylor, say her name until we win. I pray to God daily, deliver me from my sin. Trying to start a revolution, and here is where we begin. Yeah, if you want some change, you gotta model it.
What else?
Yeah, speak about your feelings, never bottle it.
Let's talk about
it. Try to do it peaceful, shout to Kaepernick. I really hate the fact that black lives not mattering. It's time to shift the narrative, I'm switching up the pattern.
Yeah,
it's a pandemic and racial wars that I'm battling. Saddened by the hate and discrimination,
yo,
it's real. They gave us freedom under control, knowledge, man, what's the deal? Man, who's created equal? I'm trying to find the equation. Founded on oppression, we live in this situation. New days coming, I know that my people waiting. Swear we praying for a change and my brothers is losing patience. Yeah, so I gotta live for Oscar Grant. And I gotta live for Eric Garner. And I gotta live for Terrence Crutcher. Swear I gotta live for Michael Brown. Yeah, man, I gotta live for Freddie Gray. And I gotta live for Betty Jones. Swear I gotta live.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Spike Freeman is with us, and Spike is with No Olympics. He wrote a piece recently, and this piece is entitled LA's Next Budget Disaster is Already on the Calendar. LA 2028, the People's Budget Movement, in the wake of the coronavirus crisis and the murder of George Floyd, has awakened Los Angeles' collective interest in the city's budget. There is broad outrage, according to Spike, at a budget that gives 54% of LA's unrestricted tax revenues to the police. And what that budget says about the city's values? People are taking to the streets by the tens of thousands to demand a move away from violent policing and toward defunding of the police. And Spike, talk to us about this conversation that people are having throughout the country, but in particular in LA, and the connection between
defunding the police. And you say that there's also a connection to the Olympics. But before we talk about the Olympics, give us an update on the efforts to defund the police in LA.
Absolutely. So the Los Angeles City budget was in crisis because of COVID-19 before the most recent uprising in the wake of George Floyd's death. And because of that crisis, there were massive cuts across the budget that hit almost every department except for LAPD. And because of that, LAPD's budget grew to 54% of the unrestricted revenues of the city, which is the largest percentage the budget had ever taken up. And this was already being contested by the People's Budget Coalition, led by BLM-LA and a number of other grassroots organizations. And the ask was, this has to go a different direction. LAPD cannot be held harmless in the midst of the COVID crisis. That demand for defunding LAPD has obviously grown as there's been a nationwide movement to defund and potentially abolish our current forms of policing. Now, what's happened in LA is over the last couple weeks, City Council has reconvened and is most likely going to cut $150 million from LAPD's budget, which is around 5% of their budget overall. So the effort has had some impact, and LAPD is no longer being held harmless within the larger COVID budget crisis that is affecting both the city and the county and the state. Every level of government is being affected by that. But there hasn't been a full transformational change in terms of police funding and priority as of yet through this process.
Okay. And the No Olympics group, you guys are also working on changing how the city is going to embrace the 2028 Olympics?
Yes. Our fundamental demand is that the city not embrace the 2028 Olympics. It's in our name of No Olympics. We oppose the games coming to Los Angeles, and we do so for a few reasons, two of which are the Olympics almost invariably run over budget, and given the budget crisis that LA is currently facing, we can't afford a situation where if you look at the average Olympics that has happened over the past 50 years, if we were to have an average cost overrun, LA as a city alone would be on the hook for between $3 and $10 billion in costs related to the games. But beyond that, the Olympics bring policing with them. The Olympics are a national special security event. They require full coordination between LAPD and DHS. LA is the home to one of the largest undocumented populations in the country. And in order to protect that population, we do not want any coordination between our local and federal policing. And also, LAPD has already been clear that in order to host the Olympics, they will need to hire 3,000 more full-time officers. And in this moment where we're talking about defunding LAPD, moving full steam ahead with LA 2028 threatens to undo these efforts that are rooted in our city's progressive values, these efforts to change the form of policing. If the Olympics come, we won't be able to do that sort of change work. And for us, that makes the Olympics, frankly, a non-starter. And we actually did some work with similar groups in Tokyo, Paris, South Korea that have seen similar impacts around policing and budgets and housing in all of these host cities. And until that changes, until the fundamentals of what Olympics do to host cities changes, then we don't think that this should be happening in any city. We are not a group that can necessarily have the power to change what's happening inside the IOC. We are a group, though, that is looking globally at what the Olympics do and hopefully sounding an alarm that can say, hey, if our values right now are around defunding the police and reducing corruption in government, the Olympics just run directly counter to those values.
Again, Spike Freeman, I'm Nicole Holt. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. Spike, in closing, talk to us about the homeless issue, houseless issue in California, and how the Olympics would further displace that population.
Yes. So the most recent numbers in LA County are over 66,000 people are unhoused within the county of Los Angeles. That's a staggering number. And past Olympics in the United States have involved increase sweeps and criminalization of the unhoused population. I think Atlanta in 1996 is the most aggressive version of that, but it also happened here in LA in 1984. And typically this is part of an Olympic effort to clean up host cities, but clean up is frankly a euphemism for deeper criminalization of the unhoused population. This is a battle that's already being fought by advocates who want housing for the unhoused rather than criminalization. And we worry that the Olympics would be a significant accelerant for this process of frankly using jails as the answer to a crisis that is one of poverty and inequality rather than one of criminalization. I'd like to add that the Olympics are in many ways an anti-democratic institution. In LA, we didn't even get to vote at a referendum on whether or not to host the games. But beyond that, because of the way the Olympics work as an accelerant for issues of development or changing the built environment or things like that, it frankly creates a situation where public input is taken out of the process of urban planning, of the process of public decision making. And as such, it creates an anti-democratic atmosphere for decision making around these issues of how we house people in our cities, how we police people in our cities, how we deal with the environment. For us as a group, we see the Olympics as an organization whose history is anti-democratic, but also whose present is in many ways anti-democratic.
And how can we follow you, Spike?
Nolympics LA is on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Spike Friedman. And also Nolympics LA publishes its own blog and has a great resource of information around the games at their website.
Again, you're listening to Spike Friedman. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Today's playlist on COVID, Race, and Democracy featured music by Her, I Can't Breathe, and Louis Bag's Ball Fist. We leave you with a classic piece by one of the greatest of all times, Bob Marley. Redemption Song, the final track on Bob Marley and the Wailers' 12th album, Uprising, produced by Chris Blackwell and released by Island Records.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Special thanks to the Pacifica COVID Task Force, Esther Iverum, and Leanna Lopez. I'm Akua Holt. Thanks for listening, and make sure to tune in tomorrow.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates, produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from our YouTube channel, Pacifica Foundation TV, or from the website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.
On July 18th and 19th, the Concert for Cuba will be live-streamed from Havana on Hot House Global, uniting 50 of the world's legendary supporters of Cuba's humanitarian efforts during the COVID crisis. Join Danny Glover, Michael Moore, Los Van Van, Omar Portorundo, and Eliades Ochoa, and so many more in this epic event. Info at hothouse.net.